James 1:13-1:21, the sixth talk in a series on James, was presented by Ron Julian on January 29, 2006, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We have been looking at the letter that James wrote. In this letter, we've seen so far that he has been talking about the testing of our faith. God puts us in situations where we are called upon to live out what we say we believe. This process shows that there is a real living faith in our hearts, and it also promotes maturity in that faith. We grow in understanding of what is important as we face these difficult choices. Many of James' readers have not been demonstrating maturity in their faith. We'll see that as we go through the letter. It's a very sober and stern sort of letter. In fact, they have been living foolishly in a way that calls their faith into question. He urges the person in that situation to call on God for wisdom. God is generous and will not hold their foolishness against them. However, they must believe in the God that they are praying to, that he is there and that he keeps his promises. If they are not just immature, but actually unbelieving, then they will get nothing from God. He then reminds them of a key place where their faith is being tested, and that is in the issue of money. He reminds them that the poor believer is in fact truly well off because he stands to inherit the crown of life. The rich unbeliever, however, will lose everything in the end. So they must decide whether they actually believe this in the midst of their lives as they decide what they will pursue and how they are going to treat other people. Okay, so in our section today, we turn to the first of a number of places where James is going to confront a theoretical antagonist. He knows that there are various objections that could be raised to what his message to the churches, and at various spots, he will speak for that person or those people, saying, okay, so someone might say something like this, and then he's going to come back and give his response to that. So today we're going to look at the first of his responses to a theoretical critic. Starting in verse 13 of chapter 1. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own desire. Then when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and when sin has run its course, it breeds death. Do not be deceived, my beloved brethren. Every good thing bestowed and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shifting shadow. In the exercise of his will, he gave us birth by the word of truth, so that we might be a kind of first fruit among his creatures. This you know, my beloved brethren, but let everyone be quick to hear, slow to speak, and slow to anger, for the anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God. Therefore, stripping off everything that is filthy and the evil that is so abundant, in humility receive the word implanted, which is able to save your souls. Okay, I'm going to argue here that in this section we have one coherent argument that has basically three parts. Part one is going to say, you do not understand yourself rightly. Part two is going to say, you do not understand God rightly. And part three, then, is going to say, therefore, this is how you should respond. Okay, so we'll go back to verse 13. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own desire. First thing we need to talk about here is this word, attempt. This comes from a word group that can either mean to tempt, to entice, to try to lure someone into doing something wrong, or it can mean to test, that is, to see what someone will do. We've already seen this word group before in James when he talked about how we should consider it all joy when we encounter various trials, or just before, talking about the blessing of the one who perseveres under trial. This is that word group. And I would argue up till this point, James has been using it. He's been using the noun, testing or trial, to mean the idea not of temptation, but of a test. And he is picturing those situations where God puts us to the test. So you might think in the context that now that we're using the verb form of this same word group, that we ought to translate it the same way. And certainly that's a tempting thing to want to do. It would seem, it would work nicely if we could somehow see him as using the words the same way in both places. But I don't think there's any way to make that work. That's not what he's doing here. When he used the noun before, he meant trial or testing. That kind of situation which tests us to see what we're made of, what sort of a person are we. But now the issue that he's addressing is whether God tempts us. The objection that the person is raising here, I think, is the idea that, well, James, the scenario that you're proposing is that God is somehow out there arrayed against me, trying to get me to sin. And that's, I think, that has to be the issue he's addressing here. His response only makes sense if that's the issue he's addressing. So when we put together James' message and when we put together the message of the New Testament as well, I think we can say that they clearly teach that God tests us. He does not tempt us. And unfortunately, it's the same word. So that's a little tricky. But in fact, I think that's what's going on here. I think it's important for us to understand exactly the issue that's being raised here and the issue that James is addressing. As I see it, James is aware that people might twist what he has said about God testing our faith into a charge against God. Here I am, a decent person who's trying to do the right thing, and you're telling me that God is out there putting me in situations trying to make me mess up. Here's God tempting me. How is that fair? How am I expected to be powerful enough to resist if God is the one pulling me towards sin? This is what I understand to be the issue behind this question. And James' answer is, basically, well, that tug, that pull that you feel in the middle of temptation is not God trying to get poor little innocent you to mess up. The pull that you feel is the pull of your own heart. It is your own desires that are pulling you toward that thing. It is not God pulling your innocent heart. You are not being reeled in. You are the one who is doing the reeling in. That's what I understand him to be saying. This theoretical opponent that James is addressing has the wrong picture of both God and himself. And he makes a brief statement about both of those things in this verse. On the one hand, God cannot be tempted by evil. Now, this is a weird little phrase in Greek, and it's a little bit hard to know how to translate it. And frankly, at this point, I don't have a strong opinion about how to translate it. But I think clearly his point here is something to suggest that it is not in God's nature to be the sort who would be luring us, trying to make innocent us sin. That's not the sort of God that he is. On the other hand, they have the wrong picture of themselves in this scenario. It is their own evil desires that is their enemy. Temptation, the power of it and the force of it rests in their desires and not God pulling against their desires. Now, I just make a side note. I'm not going to go into this very much. I'm probably not the one to do it. But on this verse often comes up in discussions of the kinds of issues that Jack has raised in his book about the sovereignty of God and God's sovereign determination of the entire story of creation. I would argue here that James is not speaking to that question one way or the other. He's not addressing the question, how did I come to be the sort of person that I am? He's not speaking to the transcendent issue of the sovereignty of God. He is rather addressing this fantasy that somehow here in the world that I live in, I'm not the problem, God is the problem. You're painting a picture here, James, that somehow God has evil motives and is trying to draw me into doing evil. And that's not true. My experience of being drawn in to the evil and in the temptations around me, the power of that is due to me because of the kind of person that I am. Now, if we were to ask the question ultimately, how did I get to be the person that I am? How am I going to change the person that I am? James, I think, in this section is only concerned with one of those questions. And that's how do you change the person that you are? That question about ultimately what is God's role in determining the whole course of history and what people do in it, that's an issue that James is not addressing. But I don't think that it speaks against that sort of picture as well, because he's not speaking to it one way or another. The issue is, I mean, the Bible clearly talks about my sin and my responsibility for the choices that I make. And James is here reiterating that. It is my desires that are drawing me into evil. And he's not suggesting anything else when he talks about God testing our faith. Okay. So, having said a little bit on about God, got the wrong picture about God, you got the wrong picture about yourself, he's going to take this theme of the sin of humankind, our responsibility for the situation we've gotten ourselves into, and explore that a little bit more. He says, then when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and when sin has run its course, it breeds death. There's birth imagery involved here. I think just as physical desire leads to conception and birth, so what he's picturing here is all of my evil desires conceive ultimately and give birth to sin, which in turn gives birth to death. So my evil desires conceive ultimately sin and death in my life. And this is what I myself accomplish. Rather than this picture of God in his evil being arrayed against me, the fact is that I am the enemy. I am the problem. And ultimately sin and eternal death, my judgment and condemnation, all of that falls on my shoulders. This is what I bring about. It is absurd to picture myself as a good person being persecuted by a malevolent God. My way, following my desires, leads me to destruction. Okay, having said that then, he wants to turn it around and let's talk about this God who's supposedly tempting me to do evil. Do not be deceived, my beloved brethren. Every good thing bestowed and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shifting shadow. Do not be deceived. James here makes a sweeping statement. It's not just every gift that God gives is good, but every good gift is from God. If you want a good and perfect gift, there is no place else to go. There is only one source of good and perfect gifts, and that's God. Why is James saying this? Why does he put it in such strong terms? I think he's doing it because of this. His theoretical critic is acting as if somehow he has seen through God, at least the God that James is proclaiming. Why would we want to have anything to do with a God who tests us, which this critic twists to mean a God who is arrayed against us, who is tempting us and trying to trip us up? Better to turn away from this God and go somewhere else. James is saying, where else are you going to go? Every perfect gift comes from God. There is no other source of good gifts out there. If you're looking for a good gift, if you are looking to be blessed, if you are looking ultimately to find stability and peace and a life that is filled with what you would like it to have, there is only one place to go. There is only one person to turn to. James uses what I think is an interesting picture here. I've made the comment that James loves to use these concrete sort of examples. This is an interesting one. I think I understand what he's doing. It's a little obscure. He calls God the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shifting shadow. God is the one who puts the lights in the sky, the sun and the moon and the stars. Where do the lights in the world come from? They come from the Father of lights. But I think light and dark here are being used as a metaphor for good and evil. The issue that we're addressing here is God somehow of dubious character trying to lure me into doing what is wrong? God puts light in the darkness, and the metaphorical picture there is of a God who brings goodness into an evil world. But I think James is highlighting here there is a difference between the metaphor and the reality. In the sky, there is movement and change. The sun moves in the sky, casting shadows that move and shift, like on a sundial. The language that James uses here is the kind of language that was used for astronomical events. And I think the idea of the variation and shifting shadow is the idea of, you know, we're talking about the phases of the moon and the shadows that are cast by the sun as they move throughout the day. Well, God as the Father of lights in the metaphorical sense, as the Father of all that is good, He is the Father of a light which is unvarying and has no shadow. There is no shadow cast by this light. It is totally light with no darkness at all. There's no sundial shadow that moves as the sun moves because there is no movement. It is all goodness. I think that's the image that he's portraying. To really cement this picture of God as the Father of lights and the one who gives all perfect gifts, James goes on to say, in the exercise of his will, he gave us birth by the word of truth, so that we might be a kind of first fruit among his creatures. James' critic has charged God with seeking to entice us into evil because James has said that God tests our faith. James is responding by saying, no, that's wrong. In fact, it's just the opposite. God is not the one tripping us up. God is the one who is saving us from our evil selves. Let me highlight a few phrases here. First of all, he says, in the exercise of his will. God was not reluctantly talked into saving us. It was his decision. His own will and purpose led him to rescue us. And I don't know about you, but this kind of language always means a lot to me. I mean, because I think my own sense of my own inadequacies and guilt always make me feel like God must be reluctant about this deal somehow. I mean, I can remember one of the first strong emotions I had as a believer was this sense that somehow I didn't belong. Maybe everybody else belonged in this company of the redeemed, but not me. Somehow, I actually articulated, you've heard me say this before, some of you, but I actually articulated it to myself that I felt like somebody had accidentally left the door open to heaven, and I had snuck in. And somebody was going to figure out somewhere along the line, oh, somebody left that door open. Did anybody get in who wasn't supposed to be here? And then I was going to be out. And absolutely, one of the most terrifying things in the Bible is the parable where Jesus invites everybody to the banquet, and he looks at that one guy and says, oh, you're not wearing any wedding clothes. You're out. I was just sure that whatever the wedding clothes were, I didn't have them, and I was going to be kicked out. So this picture of God exercising his will, it was his determined purpose to do this thing, to reach out to people who are evil and headed for death and to save them. That kind of language means a lot to me. I mean, it has always meant a lot to me. Then he says, he gave us birth. Your translation may not highlight this, but this is birth language again. It's the same word that was used earlier when he talked about how he used two different words for giving birth, that that our desires conceive and give birth to sin, and sin gives birth to death. Well, now here, on the other side of it, we picture God giving birth to us. Rather than our evil giving birth to our death, ultimately, now we are seeing God giving birth to us, giving us new life. It is the new birth, I think, that he's talking about here, which is, of course, an idea that goes all the way back to Jesus. So the result is not giving birth to death, but a new life where we stand to inherit the crown of life. So a birth into life instead of a birth into death. This birth comes about, he says, by the word of truth. James speaks in various ways in this letter of a word, a message that saves us. He does not use the language of the gospel. He doesn't talk about the gospel. But I think what he's talking about is, in fact, what we call the gospel. The word of truth is the word of the one that we follow, the word about Jesus, the word from Jesus. It is the message of salvation that has been brought through the Messiah. James is sometimes criticized. Martin Luther didn't like the letter of James because it doesn't talk enough about Jesus. But I think while James mentions Jesus a handful of times in the letter, he is implying that he is talking about the gospel message and what Jesus came to do throughout the letter. And this is one of those places. The word of truth is the true message that Jesus brought of how we are to ultimately find salvation. Now, I'm not entirely sure what to do with about this language of making us a kind of first fruit among his creation. The idea of the first fruit is when you have the harvest, the first fruit that you harvest was supposed to go to God. You offered that to God. Part of the logic of that is you don't get in all the fruit and make sure you have enough, and then if you got some left over, you give it to God. You give him the first as a recognition and acknowledgement that he is the source of all of these blessings and that you're happy to give him as an offering of gratitude, the first of your fruits, recognizing that you believe that there will be more to the harvest and he will come through for you. There come to be two ideas associated then with the idea of first fruits. First is the first in time. If you talk about first fruits metaphorically, that's the first of the harvest. And often in the New Testament, the New Testament authors, Paul, I think, uses this word often that way. When he's talking about the first believers, you know, in this area, I went and I preached to this group, and there are these first people who believed. He will refer to them as the first fruits from that area or something like that. And so it's possible that James is using that language here, that somehow he's picturing when he says to make us this, he means, well, we're the first believers, and of course there'll be more, but we're the first fruits. That's possible. But when he says first fruits among his creation or among his creatures, it seems to me that it's more likely that he means something different. And I think the idea is that the first fruits, that word came to be to just refer to an offering to God. The first fruits are the thing that you offer to God. And when you offer something to God now, it becomes God's. It is now holy. The first fruits are those fruits of the harvest that are unique. They have been dedicated to God. The rest of the fruit is just ordinary, mundane fruit. You just take it and you eat it. But the first fruits are unique in their belonging to God. They have been dedicated to Him. And I think that's the picture that James has in mind here, that among all of the creatures that God has made, the redeemed have been called out by God to be a unique possession to Him, to be the first fruits from among creation. We are that portion of creation that has been uniquely dedicated to Him and belong to Him. I think that's what he's getting at. It's a little tough to say. Okay, so James is saying here, it was God's own decision to give us new birth through the gospel, the word of truth, so that we might come to be a unique and holy possession of God among all his creation. That's how I would put together what he said. Far from being out to get us, he is the only hope we have, and he has shown that by proclaiming new birth through the message of the gospel. Okay, so far, relatively straight sailing here, I think. We're not in too deep waters. We come to a little harder interpretive decision when we come to this next section. And in fact, I'm making an interpretive decision and even including it in what we've been talking about, because I think most people would actually draw a line at this point and say, well, we're moving on to something else at this point. But I don't think we are. And let me explain. Here's what he says. This you know, my beloved brethren, but let everyone be quick to hear, slow to speak, and slow to anger. For the anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God. This verse has given me trouble for years, because it's one of those things that when you just look at it by itself, it seems pretty obvious what it is that it's talking about. But when you put it back into the context of James, it's not at all obvious that that obvious thing is what he really means. The obvious idea is, well, look, this is kind of a new proverb. We've come along now, and let me give you a proverb about how we ought to treat each other. When you and I are interacting with each other, how should I treat you? Here's what I should do. I should be quick to hear. I should listen to what you're saying. I should be slow to speak. So I should shut up and not be interrupting you, but I should let you have your say as opposed to trying to have my say. And slow to anger. If there's something about what you said that I don't like, I should restrain myself and be slow to respond in anger, because anger is not a good thing. That's not what God wants, is for us to be angry. Well, that's a great idea. That would be a great proverb. I have nothing against that proverb. That's good advice. I would all encourage you to listen to each other, listen more, talk less, and don't get angry. I'm all for it. So go do that. But I'm inclined to think that that's not actually what James is getting at here, because this verse is not by itself. It's surrounded by other things which seem to me to suggest a flow of thought that's quite different. Now, let me show you what I'm thinking about. First of all, James just got done speaking of a message of God giving us new birth through the word of truth. And now he says, let everyone be quick to hear. A strong possibility is that when he says being quick to hear, he means quick to hear this message, quick to hear the word of truth that he was just talking about. Then notice the verse immediately following. In the verse immediately following, he's back to talking about the word again. If he took off to talk about how we ought to not get angry with each other, now he's back again to talking about how we ought to respond to the word. He urges them to receive the word with humility. Well, receiving the word, the message, with humility sounds an awful lot like being quick to hear and slow to speak. That is, I ought to humbly listen to what this word has to say, as opposed to speaking back and saying, no, you've got it all wrong. Notice how well that fits with the context. He's speaking to someone who is basically piping up and saying, no, there's something wrong here. This is not, James, you don't have it right. Basically, we've got these three parts. Part one, When you are tempted, it is your own evil heart that is pulling you down, not God. Your own evil ultimately gives birth to sin and death. Part two, in contrast, God is the source of every good and perfect gift. In fact, it was his own decision to give us new birth through the gospel message. So then part three, very reasonably, can be, so the real issue is how are you going to respond to this message? Your charge against God shows your arrogance and unwillingness to hear God out. But when presented with the word of truth, you should be quick to hear it, slow to talk back, as if somehow you understood better, and especially slow with your human anger, the anger you have shown in your hostility to my message and your charges against God. Now, the advantage of taking it in this way is that it's all very coherent. It all makes a great deal of sense when you put it together in that way. Now, I admit, you pull that verse out of context, and that's not the first thing that comes to your mind when you think about slow to speak and slow to anger. But in the context, I think it's more likely not to be a lesson in getting along with people, but in essence, a lesson in the necessity of getting along with God. God has proclaimed a message. The critic is busy explaining how James is all wrong and angrily dismissing the sort of God who would treat us in this way. The critic thinks that he is a defender of what is righteous and good. Obviously, a God like the one James is describing should be rejected because he is trying to trip us up. James is telling them that their angry hostility is not righteous or good. It is not producing the righteousness of God. The only hope for true righteousness is found by humbly listening to the gospel message. And then that is what he finishes up by saying in the last verses we're going to look at here. Therefore, stripping off everything that is filthy and the evil that is so abundant, in humility receive the word implanted, which is able to save your souls. The language here is of undressing. It is as if I am wearing filthy rags, and I should take them off and throw them away. Now, we should talk about what this means. Is he saying that I should eliminate all sin from my life, and then I can receive the word which will save my soul? I don't think that he can mean that, because that would be a problem. At least for me, it would be a problem. If I could eliminate all sin by myself, then I wouldn't need the gospel to save my soul. If I have to solve the problem of sin in my life in order to receive the gospel, then I don't need to receive the gospel because the problem's already been solved. So I don't think he's saying, get rid of every trace of sin and then God will consider you worthy to hear the message and be saved. Instead, I think he is basically talking about repentance. The critic is arrogantly justifying himself. I don't need to listen to you, James. Your message doesn't make sense. The God you're proclaiming is out to trip me up. I'm all right the way I am. But James has made it clear, we are the evil ones. God is perfectly good and the giver of every perfect gift, especially the gospel. So what we need to do is stop justifying ourselves. We need to stop acting as if our filthy rags were elegant clothing. We need to get rid of them. We need to say, I don't want it anymore. That's not for me. And we do that ultimately by humbly receiving the word of truth. James says we should receive the word implanted. I think he is saying that the word of truth, the gospel, is something that is meant to take root in our hearts and grow. And it is that word, he says, that can save our souls. And he makes it very clear here, our souls need saving. The critic who would charge God with evil is in fact filled with evil himself, and the result is death. If our souls are going to escape destruction, we must stop trying to justify ourselves and cling to our own evil, and instead respond with humility to the message of the gospel, taking it to heart. So, let me summarize then what I think James is saying in this section one more time. In response to James' picture that God tests our faith, the critic charges God with evil. How can I be blamed when God is trying to make me sin? James gives a three-part response. Part one, you are not the innocent party here. The pull of temptation comes from your own evil desires, which gives birth to sin and death. Part two, God is not the evil party here. He is the source of all that is good and perfect. In fact, rather than trying to trip us up, he himself has given us new birth through the gospel, the word of truth. If it weren't for him, no one would escape destruction. Part three, so your hostile response to God is all wrong. What you should do is shut up and listen to the gospel. Repent and humbly receive the gospel, which is able to save your souls. Okay, so I'd like to just take a few minutes to ruminate a bit on these three parts to James' argument here. Part one, the problem is me. James is joining the universal testimony of the biblical authors in saying that my problem is my own evil heart, which will in the end destroy me. This is not a new thought around here. I'm not going to elaborate on that problem. It's one we discuss a lot. I do think that any gospel message that downplays the seriousness of the problem of the human heart is not a gospel message. What's interesting to me in this passage that I just wanted to comment on is the way that James is tying a denial of understanding my own complicity, my own evilness, my own heart, with making this charge against God. The person can say, well, God's trying to trip me up, but in order to make that charge, he has to be ignoring his own state. He has to be ignoring what's really true about himself. Now, you and I may not have ever made this specific charge against God. You are trying to make me sin. I don't know if you have. I've thought about it. I'm not aware that I've ever actually come to that place where that charge is a charge I've made against God. I have charged God with many things along the way, but I don't think I have charged God with that. But it seems to me that all of us have wrestled with times of bitterness toward God where we have our own charge to make against him. And it seems to me that the pattern we see here in James holds up for all of it. It is always true that when we make these charges against God, we are being hypocrites. Part of the way we can make a charge against God is by selling ourselves a wrong picture of ourselves, as well as a wrong picture of God. In our bitterness and confusion, we feel justified. God, I'm in the right, and you should not be doing this. We may pay lip service to the idea that we're sinners, but at the moment, we don't really believe it. I mean, that's not at the forefront of our attention. We're hiding from the fact that every day of our lives, we voluntarily participate in the destruction of our own souls. I mean, that's an awful thing if you think about it. And I'm quite happy along the way to contribute to the destruction of your soul, too. It's bad. It's really bad. If it were not for the total goodness and generosity of God, I would have already totally destroyed myself. We're trying to ignore that when we make the charge against God. God, let's forget about what I truly deserve. God, let's forget about what I truly need from you and what you have promised to provide. I'm angry because I'm not getting what I want right now in one way or another. Every charge we make against God involves in part a willful refusal to know ourselves as we are. We don't recognize who God is and his goodness because we're not seeing ourselves in comparison with him. Okay, part two of James' message is, if we are the problem, God is the answer. And I think there are two important ideas about God that James expresses here. First of all, God is the only source of good and perfect gifts. And this is an idea that we will wrestle with all our lives. I know I wrestle with this. I'm sure that you wrestle with this. What he's saying is, it's not even close. There is no place else to go. You and I believe in theory, as believers, that God is the source of every perfect gift. But in our experience, we are very, very inclined to think that somehow there are some other deals out there that look pretty good as well. We are tempted to think that God doesn't know what he's doing. I mean, if you've ever even been in that spot where you're trying desperately to convince God, God, this is what I need, this is what you ought to do, we recognize how much we are tempted to think that God doesn't know what he's doing. There are things that I think I must have to be truly blessed, and yet God is not giving them to me. There are problems that I really need to have go away in order to be truly blessed, and yet God is not making those problems go away. Earlier, James said it's the man who perseveres under trial who is blessed, because he will inherit the crown of life. In fact, what we can see here is that James believes basically that only the man who inherits the crown of life can be considered blessed. That's the ultimate gift that God has to offer. There is no other source of truly perfect gifts besides God. If we don't receive the good gifts that he intends for his people, then there is no good gift left to have. Now, we all recognize that in the midst of our lives, this can be very emotionally complicated. It's hard for me to see why God is taking my life ultimately in the direction that it needs to go, and that his blessing is the blessing that I most need. But in the end, the issue is really very simple. Either God is the good God that the Bible claims him to be, or else he is not. And just the depth of my desire, or the power of my sense that I really need to be free from this suffering, doesn't change the question and doesn't change the answer. Is God good? Yes. He is the only place I am going to find ultimately a blessing. And then the other important idea about God that James expresses is concerning our salvation. We are in the process of destroying ourselves, of throwing our souls into the eternal garbage heap. God most shows his goodness and love in that he himself has decided to save our souls, to give us new birth, to rescue us through the message of Christ and his salvation. This, again, is a very common biblical theme. He's defending the goodness of God. Do you want to know how good God is? Do you want to know the power of his love? How great is his love? Look at the gospel. Look at Jesus hanging on the cross. Look at the mercy God is extending to us, even though we are his enemies. But notice this point works together with the first one. It really doesn't have much force unless we recognize ourselves and our true problems. If I think of myself as being basically an okay guy who deserves every good thing that he's got coming to him, then God's goodness in saving me, it doesn't seem very good. It's kind of like, well, great, God finally figured out what a good guy I am. What took him so long? I mean, that sounds silly, but in fact, there's an emotional dynamic that's a lot like that in the way we think about God. It's hard to marvel at God's love for saving my soul if I don't really believe my soul needs saving. James' perspective is the greatest evidence that he can point to that God is good and on our side is that he has reached out to rescue us from ourselves. And then part three of his message, shut up and hear the gospel. And this is going to seem silly, but I just had this picture as I was thinking about this. Imagine that Jesus walked in here today. You don't have to listen to me. Jesus is here. He's going to talk to us all. He can tell us. So as he begins to talk, we start interrupting him. No, 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 you don't understand. No, no, it's not like that. No, no, see, here's the real issue, Jesus. No, see, here's what's going on. No, 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 see, what you need to do for me here is, I'm not looking for you to tell me that. You need to do this. This is what I need to have done. Well, it's a kind of a funny picture, because if we picture him actually being here, it's hard to imagine that I would talk back to him in that way. But if your experience is anything like mine, we in fact do this sort of thing all the time. When it comes to the gospel, we are quick to talk back and slow to listen. We want our lives to go a certain way, and if they don't, God needs to defend himself. That is a very easy attitude to take on. And why is it an easy attitude to take on? I think it's because we're still trying to get a hold of parts one and two. That is, I am the problem and God is the solution. My own evil is leading me to destruction, and the mercy of God is rescuing me from myself. If I can get those points clear, if I can see that's who I am, that's my problem, that's who God is, and that's what he has to offer, then it is easy for me to understand the power of the gospel message. It is easy for me to humbly sit back and say, that's what I need to hear. That's what I need to understand, because that's the real issue. Is there any question that our true problem is our own sin? I mean, if we really get down to it and look at the situation, sin makes life ugly and painful. Sin makes me guilty before God. Sin is going to drag me down into the garbage heap that is hell. That seems like a serious problem to me. I'm trying to think about if any of my other problems are as serious as that problem. And if you just are objective about it, it doesn't seem that they are. Is there any question that the only source of life and blessing is God? I need mercy, and God is offering it in the gospel. Nobody else is. I need my soul to be restored, and God is able to do it and is offering to do it. I can't do it. You can't do it. Nobody I can go to can do it. Only God. I need life instead of death. If I invest my life in riches, in the end, I'm going to die. And if I invest myself in fame, in the end, I'm going to die. None of that stuff can save me. But God can, and has offered to do so. If that is so, there's no question what my problem is. There's no question who is the source of the answer to my problem. Then the appropriate response is to shut up. We need to stop telling God that he doesn't know what he is doing and listen to the message that will save our souls. Okay, so one of the advantages of teaching from James is you kind of get to preach with people. So I got to do that a little bit. So we have a few minutes if you have any questions or comments.
Let's see, looking at beginning of verses 19 and 21, in my King James it has there or wherefore. And so I'm wondering, what does the Greek use, since it kind of seems to debunk, as you propose, okay, let's put away wrath, sit down, listen, and so forth. Does the wherefore in 19 and verse 21 seem to imply a hook into the previous discussion? So,
yes, there is a Greek word there. It's dia, I think, not dia, but dia, and which is something like wherefore or on account of which or something like that. Yeah, and I think it does. I'm inclined to think that, though, that it does not tie. See, if we draw a line at 19 and say this is a new paragraph, new thought, we've moved on to a new idea, then that therefore would be seen as presumably tying back to the very last thing that he said in the verse before. Mm-hmm. I'm inclined to see it as a therefore, which refers back to kind of the whole point that he's been making. Yeah. I mean, okay. this is his summing up of this thing that he has been saying. How should we respond? In the light of everything I've just said, how should we respond to this?
We have someone in our life who, instead of blaming their temptation on God, blames it on Satan.
Oh, yeah.
I'd be curious about your comment on that.
Yeah. Well, James does not discount the influence of Satan in the world. We're going to see later on where he has the, chapter 4, starting like in 7, submit therefore to God, resist the devil and he will flee from you, draw near to God and he will draw near to you. cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. So he clearly sees Satan as being a force. I don't mean that, not a person, but he is in fact a force for evil in the world. He is seeking to bring about evil in the world. He would draw me into evil if he could. So I think James believes that, but James also believes that, notice in his answer, I mean, we can see his fundamental take, because if he had the perspective that your friend has, it's just crying out, this is the place to do it. When the person makes the charge, God is tempting me, James can come along and say, God isn't tempting you, Satan is tempting you. I mean, that's the place to say it right there. And yet his answer isn't that. His answer is, you are tempting yourself. I mean, it is your desire that's drawing you in. So certainly Satan is a deceiver. He is a tempter. He is seeking to destroy the people made in the image of God. And so he would draw us into our destruction if he could. But to say that that's the case is not to deny my own responsibility for the evil that I commit. I mean, this goes all the way back. The old people here remember Flip Wilson. You remember, the devil made me do it. Do you remember that? Well, I mean, it's that idea that somehow it's not my fault. The devil made me do it. Well, that's not James' perspective. It is my fault. The devil may be seeking to destroy me, but it is my own evil desires that are responding to his attempts. I mean, he tried to destroy Jesus. He didn't get anywhere because Jesus had no evil desire to be caught by the temptations. So, Satan, I don't deny the reality of Satan, but what I see the Bible saying is I should be aware that this world is Satan's world, in a sense that the foolishness and blindness that I see in the world is in part being fostered by the God of this world who is seeking our destruction, and I should understand that. I should understand that he's like a hungry lion waiting for someone to devour. So I should be aware that's the case. But when it comes to what should I do, the message is always, you repent, recognize your own evil, call out to God for mercy and deliverance. And Satan really isn't in the picture. I mean, even here in James, resist the devil and he will flee from you. I mean, it's turn to God and there's nothing that Satan can do. Because ultimately the issue is between me and God. Am I gonna say, you win? You're right. I need you, or am I not? And Satan, he can't get in there in that picture ultimately. Until God puts someone in the situation where basically now their heart is hard and they won't listen anymore. Now Satan's got a free rein. He can deceive as much as he wants. So, yes and no, which is my answer to every question, is yes and no. Does anyone else have a question I could answer yes and no to? Okay.
Perhaps.
Okay.
I have a lot of thoughts about this that are all crashing together at one time, so I'm going to try to form a question that you can answer. Back in Genesis, you know, God creates everything. Mm-hmm. And in chapter 3, it begins, now the serpent was more crafty than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. Mm-hmm. So it kind of leads into what I'm going to try to formulate into a question. If God made all the beasts of the field and the serpent was crafty, then you kind of get the impression that God made the serpent crafty. Okay, so, and chapter 3 goes on to where Eve was tempted by the serpent and all. So my question is, Eve, at this very beginning here, her heart listened to the serpent. So there was that bit of her that said, ooh, that does look tasty. I think I'll eat it. So if God created everything, which we believe it to be, and you see where I'm going with this,
mm-hmm.
and
I do.
Eve has this little piece of her heart that says, ooh, tasty. Where did the piece of evil that's in her heart and all of our hearts that goes towards this bad stuff, where did that come from, if not from God who created everything? And where did Satan come from, and where did all that?
There was a little bit of evil on an asteroid that came in from outside of creation.
Big bang.
Yeah. Very well put.
I don't think
yeah,
where did
absolutely.
It come from is a yes
that's
or no
the,
question.
That's the, you know, the mother of all yes and no answers is on that question. But, okay, so let me speak for myself here, okay? I mean, I've been working with Jack for a quarter of a century. I mean, we've been working together for a long time. Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. So
I just want you to know I had an hour-long coffee session with Jack several years ago
right.
about this very question, and
right.
he said that was the $60,000 question.
Right, right. Yes. It's that too.
Yeah.
yeah,
ask Ron.
So, and I could tell you the answer that Jack gives to this question, which seems to me to be pretty reasonable, but I feel like I'm on the issue of how ultimately you resolve that. I feel like I'm a little bit behind. Like, it seems reasonable. It's the answer that seems to make the most sense out of everything. So I'll buy it. But here's where I'm coming from. This is what seems to me to be indisputable, which is the foundation that I stand on when I look at the answer Jack provides and I say, okay, well, that's the only way I know how to get where I think definitely is true. And here's the scenario, is that what I see in the Bible is the idea that my problem is a problem of my will, that I am the sort of person who does what is wrong by nature, because that's what I want. I choose out of the kind of person that I am. And the Bible's message is not just, oh, if you choose the right thing, then you can save yourself. The Bible's message is what Jesus is doing on the cross is offering mercy for me so that God can restore me, which means God behind the scenes working in such a way that I become the sort of person that I am not now. I become a person who is holy and righteous and good, and I will be that throughout eternity. So what that tells me at the heart of the biblical message is the idea that I choose out of the sort of person that I am, but I'm not in control of the sort of person that I am. Okay? What's clear, what the Bible is saying over and over again, is my redemption will be God interfering back behind the scenes to make me, to remake me into something that I'm not. That's central to the gospel message as I understand it. Now, so I'm very, very much on board with the idea that on the one hand, I am responsible for what I do because I am betraying my very character when I make my choices. When I choose what I do, I'm showing the kind of person that I am. In heaven, when I choose righteousness, I will be showing the sort of person that I am. And I will be worthy of praise and honor as a righteous, holy person. But in another sense, the responsibility for me having gotten to the place where I am, that is not mine. When we come to that harder question of where does the evil in the world come from, it seems to me that the answer that Jack has proposed is that God in his transcendence has decided that ultimately a story of redemption is a better story to tell than the story merely of people who started out righteous from the beginning. And so, yes, God is not evil in any sense, but he has decided to tell a story that starts with evil so that he can redeem it. Now, there are intellectual problems with that, trying to sort that out, and I would have to say that the kind of answers that Jack as a philosopher provides seem to me better than the answers that the objectors to that provide. So I'm kind of on board with that. But what I am definitely on board with is the idea that where I stand right now, if my will is autonomous from God, separate from God, then I'm sunk because I cannot fix myself. And that's what seems to me to be of central importance. That's a long answer, and it's a little bit of a dodge, but it's honest. I'm being honest as to where I stand. If you asked me, am I convinced of the sovereignty of God over everything that happens in the world? I say yes, pretty much, because I don't see any other way to explain what I am deeply convinced of, which is the nature of the gospel. That's where I sit.
Well, the thought that occurs to me in a short follow-up is that if, again, God is bigger than anything we can possibly imagine, and from our discussion too, if the only way we're going to know who God is this comparison of evil and good and making the right choices, then we see evil as a bad thing. But it could be, in the bigger picture, that evil is really a good thing, because the way he set up the whole story, the only way for us to recognize God is by having evil and good in that whole act. And so it could be a good thing.
Well, I could go there, but the problem is we have to redefine what we mean by good in different senses, because what we're saying is it's good to discover how bad evil is. So there, I mean,
beneficial.
We have to be, yes. So we have to have a different concept of good. I mean, all of us should stay away from what a sentence like evil is good, what that sounds like it might be saying, that's totally wrong. Evil is not good. But it might be, the story with evil in it might indeed be the perfect story to tell. And that's, yeah. Okay, so those are hard issues, and I kept us way too late, but thanks. We'll pick it up next week.